how to bring both our practice and what we've learned out into our lives, our lives in the world. And most of you know, having done these retreats before, that this is a big challenge. So I just, all of us would like to just say a few words about how to do this. There's one principle of Dharma that I think we really have to understand deeply, and that is that when we practice, in all the dimensions of practice, wisdom grows. And when we don't practice, wisdom wanes, wisdom weakens. So it's not as if we come to a retreat and we get a little package of wisdom and then we take it with us. It's a living, dynamic process, and it needs continual nurturing. So we need to learn how to practice the growth of wisdom in our lives. Otherwise, it simply becomes a memory. You know, we have a memory of something we might have learned sometime, but it's not alive within us, and it doesn't bring the benefit. So there are a few areas just to consider in terms of how we can keep wisdom growing in our lives, keep the practice growing. And you're all familiar with these. This is not going to be anything new to you. When my first teacher, Munindraji, came to the States for the first time, this was quite early on, I forget exactly, but maybe it was in the 70s or 80s. And there was a lot of enthusiasm among practitioners for meditation, for deep practice, for getting enlightened. This was what people were practicing for. But what he noticed was that people were not giving so much attention to the practice of sila, you know, the ethical conduct. And he made the comment that it's like somebody who does all this meditation practice with a lot of effort and intensity, but is not doing it on the foundation of ethical conduct, that it's like somebody being in a boat rowing as hard as they can to get to the other side of the river, but not untying the boat from the dock. So you can be in the boat rowing and putting all this energy and not really getting any place. In order to cross the river, the effort has to be based, right, on a strong foundation of the ethics of non-harming. That is the foundation of our practice. It's the foundation of wisdom. So one arena to really investigate, you know, in our lives, in the world, is how we can refine our practice of sila. In the Buddhist context, that's usually described as the five precepts. You know, different spiritual traditions may define it somewhat differently, but it's the basic. It's the basic principles of not harming. You know, not killing and not stealing, and not committing sexual misconduct, and not lying, and not taking intoxicants to the point of clouding and diluting the mind. Each one of these could be a rich area of investigation. Now, I think normally we have the assumption that we're basically good people, we basically have the intention not to harm, and then leave it at that. It can be very interesting to explore more deeply the subtleties of each one of those precepts. You know, do we basically not kill, but If there are some ugly little insects in our house, do we take them out or do we... You know, we basically don't go around stealing things, but are we taking more than we need? You know, are we using more than we need? The whole area of intimate sexual relations, huge area for inquiry. Because often when sexual energy is strong, you know, we're feeling this passion, it's when we feel most alive and energized and the world feels great. And sometimes that energy can be so overpowering of our ethical considerations, you know, where we get involved in situations that are harmful either to ourselves and others. At one point, Sayadaw Upandita was giving a talk on sila, ethics, and he was going on and on about sexual misconduct, and he was speaking in Burmese. And he must have spoken for maybe 10 minutes. And then the translator translated his whole long talk into four words. And the four words were, lust cracks the brain. Lust cracks the brain. It does. So we need a lot of care. When that energy is strong, we just need to be mindful. You know, how are we using it? And are we using it in a loving way, in a respectful way? So that's another whole area of practice. This is Dharma practice. You know, in the area of right speech, not lying. Huge. And most of us are probably not great liars. But are we little liars? You know, just shading things, exaggerating, telling lies to protect, or in one way or another, just not being totally honest, totally straight. An area to investigate. So ethics, this is one way. If we take this on consciously as a practice, and we really examine and look in our lives, how can I refine each of these areas? That brings a lot of awareness, a lot of mindfulness to our practice. One of the most transforming arenas for the development of wisdom, and I think this particular one, I think, has been as insightful or more insightful than anything I've experienced on the cushion. So it's really a powerful place to look. And that is in the, excuse me, in the midst of our daily lives, when we're engaged in our relationships and work and other people and all the busyness, when we find ourselves in a situation or a place where we're suffering, where there's really some difficulty going on, instead of simply drowning in it, getting lost in it, and instead of blaming others for how we feel, we can take the time of our own difficulty, our own suffering, to really investigate what is going on here. Because right in that situation, the Four Noble Truths are alive. They're not theoretical, they're not Buddhist philosophy at that time. There's suffering, and we're in the middle of it. What is its cause? can we really examine deeply within ourselves, how are we relating to this situation that is causing suffering? If we can investigate and really look carefully and honestly without blaming others, you know, for our suffering, then we begin to uncover the patterns in our own minds that keep us trapped. And we get a taste of the third noble truth, even just for a few moments. We really see how to untangle the suffering that's there. I had one wonderful interchange with somebody. This goes back to my 30s when I was in a relationship and we were having a little disagreement. In the course of the conversation, she turned to me and she said, "Stop making me feel aversion." And of course, I started to laugh, which did not help. There is a profound insight that arises when we realize that no one makes us feel a certain way. Different things may happen, and other people and conditions may cause difficulties, but how we feel about them is totally up to us. And so we can learn that even in the face of difficulty and suffering and complex situations, the potential for freeing our hearts, freeing our minds, lies completely within ourselves. So that's tremendously empowering. Our freedom is not dependent on other people being a certain way. So this is, this is a very empowering lesson to learn about ourselves, and living in the world and being engaged in all the busyness and the complexity and the struggles, it's a very rich arena for this exploration. In this instance, life really does become our practice. It's not just a nice slogan. Right? We're using our life to understand freedom. I think that's all. We're going to take turns kind of giving some different suggestions. There's a lot more, but these are the few of the things that I think are really important to take back with you.
I think that in daily life we can have, and it will help us to have, a large view of what is practice. And I agree completely with Joseph, that we have to be right there in a world of intention to continue the journey of liberation. That has to be a kind of primary motivation which we settle into. But how that's manifest can be in many different things. And I just want to kind of encourage a broad view of practice. At times, we may feel that we're more interested in learning, in reading, in intellectual exploration of the Dharma, in understanding the text, and that's fine. And at times, we may be more connected to the practice of how we are, how we act. At times, we may feel it's in community and Sangha, and in volunteering or in giving, and at times it may be that our interest is much more in what you might call formal practice, which is really what my experience is sitting in the morning on my meditation cushion. And allowing the relationship to the Dharma in daily life to be very rich, but not to get stuck too much on one thing that we feel is a test of the Dharma. So if my meditation practice in the morning doesn't feel sort of that interesting, well, then the whole thing collapses. It's not, it's very big. The Buddha himself was, in the text, was encouraging all these different levels, because we are a human being full of capacities. So at times he was encouraging just understanding, deeply understanding the point of view of Dharma, which is big point of view of reality. It's having a world view and even a philosophy of life, which is different from the one that we learnt in school. Having this big view is very helpful, but not to get stuck too much, for example, on the intellectual. And if you read more Dharma books, then you know the number of Dharma books you read is an indication of your progress up the ladder to awakening. And awakening is when you've read your 1,000th Dharma book. not getting stuck on any one model, but allowing yourself to be a rather big a vessel, and so that's one piece. And to be very, and just to follow the interest. Where's the interest for you? Where's the juice in the Dharma? And it can change. And just follow, allowing that to be part of it. Second thing I want to say is to be very careful of the world of expectations and self-judgments or self-evaluations or self-measuring. In daily life, whenever we start measuring how we are in the Dharma, we always come up with a negative kind of assessment. Because samsara is talking so loudly. It's just got a very loud voice, and it sometimes drowns all the other delicate voices that we have in our soul. And when we look at ourselves, oh, it's all gone, and had, you know, wonderful retreat, and now it's all disappeared. And first of all, allowing the changing conditions to change us. It happens. It is what happens. It will happen. The conditions of a retreat give us one set of experiences. The conditions of being in the middle of Tel Aviv, working and arguing with our mother-in-law or whoever is going to give another set of experiences. But we are essentially bigger than the conditions. Or the conditions will move us in different directions, but we don't need to. We are free within conditions, but allowing that and saying, yes, the conditions are changing things in me, allowing that to happen without too much measuring. I sometimes feel we're a little bit like my dog. You know, my dog kind of looks there, but walks there. And I'm watching it, and it's amazing. The dog is sort of looking there, but is walking there. And we're a bit like that. We move and change and develop, but we're looking somewhere else, thinking, oh, it's not happening, and we're here. Oh, it's not happening, and we're there. Oh, it's not happening. And you see people changing, you know, really radically in their life, and the sort of the self doesn't appreciate it and doesn't notice it. And the reason is that the self is very bad, rather limited. Measuring stick, and you can't rely on the self to tell you the truth about where you are. You're much bigger than this self, and this self is trying to tell you where you are. So it doesn't work. So leave the measuring and trust the Dharma. If you look after the Dharma will look after you. Trust the Dharma to work inside in a way which we don't really need to measure or need to check. And if we, you know, if we want to check ourselves, the best place is when we're really challenged by those difficult moments of arguing, of anger, or you know, we can maybe have a sense, yeah, well, I wasn't quite as reactive today as I was a couple of years ago. It's okay, it's a reasonable check. I didn't know. It's reasonable. At the moments of the test of daily life, they're the moments where we are tested in the kind of heat. The other thing is, we can't do this thing alone. And please trust also the power of Sangha and be involved in Sangha, even if at times Sangha feels a bit irritating, because you just don't particularly feel like going out in the evening with this group or that group, and it maybe it's not what you expected, but you never mind. Trust also Sangha. Take refuge in Sangha. And it's because we can't do this thing alone. We are formed by life. So to share that view, that it's just the view. I've been sitting with a sitting group now like 9 years, 10 years in the north. I just go to the sitting group because of Sangha. It's just the sense of this is the right way in which taking refuge in Sangha works. That we gather and we look at life differently and we explore things differently, and it gives us another view. So the view of Dharma is held and protected through Sangha. So do join groups and so on, again, without measuring too much. Just trust Sangha does work, and join activities, join Tovana groups. There will always be groups. We'll talk about that in a minute. But there will always be activities. So do remember that. And the final piece I want to say is about formal meditation, which it is golden to have periods of silence in the day, or a period of silence. And but again, even if we sit and we feel it's just thoughts coming up and going, it's still something that body-mind stops and looks at our life. And even if the thought is just full of thought, doesn't matter. Even the fact that we know it's full of thoughts is already sitting. It's already being clear about where we are. Yes, I'm sitting, my mind is full of thoughts. That's fine. And so do take that space if you can in your life. And sometimes it may be many moments in the day which are little stops. They're very, very valuable. You can see it like little points of light in the day that shine, that light up our day through little moments. So just this act of stopping and recollecting is the old translation of sati in English, which is an old-fashioned word in English. It means, again, to collect ourselves again, recollect, to recollect, to remember where we are. Ah, okay, stop. Here I am. So practice formally if you can, you know, every day, and to give that space, and it can set up the day right for us. And walking is beautiful, don't forget. It doesn't have to be sitting on a cushion. Walking is a wonderful practice within daily life because it's Dharma in movement. So I think that's all I want to say right now.
Well, I've been seeing in my own practice how I've intensified the interest in the Siddha, and how it's true that for a number of years, it was, oh, it's going to come along by itself. You know, you practice, you're mindful, and it's just going to be there, part of my life. And still getting very entangled in situations with people having conflicts. And so I felt some years back to really look at it more closely at this aspect. And actually, it really heightened the mindfulness. It's so interesting. Now, it feels like the practice is at a very clearly different level. Because of that intention of working with speech, and that intention of doing less, simplifying, and using the resources just to the extent that I need rather than want. It's just so fascinating to really bring the practice to that level, which of course then broadens it to all of life, right? I mean, do I walk or do I take the car? Do I take a train or do I take a plane? You know, how do I care for the planet? Do I throw my bottle? And where do I throw it? All of these little things, when we bring the practice to that level, it feels just so joyful and out of a place of joy. So this brings me to the very clear aspect of wholesome intention, which the first piece as an aspect of wholesome intention in the Eightfold Path is renunciation. And that's letting go, right? Being is good, being mindful, being fully present, but then it's the aspect of dropping thoughts, dropping ideas, judgments, dropping needs, really that path of letting go in relationship to renounce, which means we do less. And actually it's fascinating to notice that the doing less in relationship to all the big ideas that we have bring us to a closer sense of presence. So that's one aspect where I've been exploring this. And in the field of the judging mind, that was kind of, you know, a tendency, which of course we all have. And in letting go, in reflection, I read some time ago Barnes Katie book about the judge and the judging mind, and I really appreciate the way that she just puts this out of minding our own business. You don't need to mess up with your neighbor's business. It's their business and God's business. So many ideas and views about, you know, what is right and wrong, and exactly that, what we don't know about, do we really need to have judgments and assumptions? It is so good. The outcome is just so wonderful. We feel much lighter. It doesn't mean not engaging, but to what extent that level can be, you know, clarified and prodded. And the last thing, because I think time is kind of flowing by, and my two colleagues have said a lot, is don't forget the metta or any of the Brahma Viharas. They are not less important practices. And as you know, I'm a very big fan of these Brahma Viharas. Just because for me, it really feels that a lot of the transformation process in relationship to the emotional life and the openness of the heart and the dropping from the head to the heart has happened, and has happened through these practices, because they're real. You know, you bring in someone and you just can sense, oh, there's really a sense of ill will. Right? And to process that. And the metta is definitely not coming easily, but to remember that that quality or compassion or joy and equanimity are the beautiful qualities of heart and mind. And so do, even if it feels difficult, remember the Brahma Viharas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it.